Coming up today, Facebook just bought WhatsApp for nearly $20 billion, foie, etc. Plus, common sense appears to be prevailing as care.data, which we discussed in depth recently, has been delayed. The rollout, that is, and I think that's largely our doing. And Wikipedia could become a 1 million page printed book. Why? Some reasons. Mostly mad ones. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science and tech to encyclopedia news and massive sacks of cash. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And we are going to be discussing WhatsApp in quite a great amount of detail in the second half of today's show. It's been a pretty interesting story to follow over the last 24 hours. Liv was up at midnight writing stories while I was underground not writing stories. So we've got a lot more to talk about, as well as the fact that in our next issue of Wired, David Rowan, editor of the magazine, has written a huge and it seems massively well-timed feature about WhatsApp. So obviously look out for that, but we will come back to that. We've also got some amazing feedback. Last week we asked for feedback and we got a lot of it in our inbox. So we're going to get to some of that about the show and about some stories later on. But first, the news. First in the news is that common sense is prevailing because care.data, it looks like, is going to be delayed. We just wanted to have a quick mention of this, didn't we, Liv?
Yeah, we discussed this at length. Was it last week?
We've discussed it twice, yeah.
Yeah. So after widespread criticism, the NHS has revealed it's going to delay the start of this scheme, which is to share medical records, for another 6 months. It was due to start in April, and it would have meant that patient records currently stored with GPs would be extracted and stored in a centralised set of databases overseen by a body called the Health and Social Care Information Centre. And that GP data would go and join hospital data and other social care data relating to patients. Now, there are some amazing potential benefits from sharing data in this way. It can help NHS allocate resources and provide a really, really rich data set for researchers. But the problem is, well, one of the main problems is it's been communicated really badly to patients. The risks haven't been highlighted to them. And most people have no idea that this is even going to be happening. And so the NHS has accepted this and is going to give us 6 months to sort of get our heads around it.
Now, I'm just going to pull out a trumpet, which I've been keeping in my pocket. It's our trumpet, and I'm going to give it a massive blow. because you've been speaking to a lot of people about this, and I think that a lot of what we've done has probably influenced this decision, genuinely.
Well, I'd like to think so. I think what we have done is help clarify what exactly is going on. And frequently we get people pointing towards our guide about this to say, in fact, yesterday someone tweeted that we provided more clear information than the NHS, which actually isn't saying a whole lot because it's massively confusing.
No, The articles traffic very, very well, so a lot of people always reading those. Well, anyway, that's enough trumpet blowing. It's going to get sickly. We did have an email that came in, actually, from Robert, who'd written, Hi, Wired, I'm Robert from Cologne, brackets Germany. We know where Cologne is, honestly. We love Germany. And really enjoy listening to the Wired podcast. In this week's episode 161, you talked about NHS care.data plans, which left me wondering what happens to the data of foreigners who were or are treated or being treated in the UK. Is their medical data also stored? And if so, is there some kind of opt-out function for them as well? Thanks, keep up the great work, Robert. Thank you, Robert. Liv, a question. Do we have an answer?
Yeah, well, I've actually asked the NHS about this. I don't think they've got back to me quite yet. Let me just quickly check.
But I think what was interesting about this is that it's GP data. And I think that people who have been treated here in maybe hospitals, you know, they're not NHS patients and they don't have NHS records in the same way that we do.
I think the key thing is whether or not you have an NHS number. And it's the NHS number that unites all the different pieces of data about you, which you've from healthcare that you've received throughout the system. So if you don't have that, then the data at least would not be in any way be able to be identified, but so I'm going to find out and hopefully we'll be able to tell you next week for sure.
We will follow up on this. Obviously, any more information you want about care.data, go to wired.co.uk, search care.data, you'll find all of our articles. You lose journalism, carrying GCHQ documents is terrorism. That was a headline we ran this week above words Liat had written.
Yes, indeed.
So we're terrorists now, are we?
Yes, well, David Miranda is apparently a terrorist. So I'm sure you remember this story. He is the partner of Glenn Greenwald, who is the ex-Guardian journalist, who is the go-to guy for Edward Snowden and all his leaks. This is relating to something that happened last August when Miranda was stopped at the airport in Heathrow, held for 9 hours, and had his belongings seized, among which there were, in fairness, 58,000 encrypted classified GCHQ files. Now, he was stopped under Section 7 of the Terrorism Act, and Miranda's argument was this breached his freedom of expression under European law, under UK law, and it was also an improper use of police powers. The Terrorism Act has been criticised a lot for this kind of, it's very overreaching, you know, it's very vague, the terminology. It's basically used to stop anyone they want. You just basically have to have some suspicion, or someone above you has to have some suspicion to stop that guy.
I've heard it described as it's a way of harassing people for anything.
Yeah, basically it is just a catch-all for harassment at the airport and at ports as well. That's what the
But Miranda, he was not involved in terrorism. In any way.
Well, this is what I can't get my head round. He obviously wasn't. Everyone knew he wasn't. Everyone knows he's the partner of Glenn Greenwald. Everyone knows what Greenwald's doing. Everyone knows that he was ferrying the documents to Greenwald. And so it seems bizarre that they could say they had reason to believe he was a terrorist. There's like a very kind of vague description of the law, which says it can be anyone who is concerned in the commission, preparation or instigation of acts of terrorism. That is not Miranda. However, it seems that they've just decided to kind of reappropriate this law, and I think there was one section in the ruling made by Justice Laws, excellent name, which said that a police officer said it was risky enough if he possibly took this to a hostile country. So it seems like this law is covering you go to a hostile country and a terrorist steals the documents for you. It doesn't seem to relate to his intention. But anyway, so this, besides saying yes, terrorism law, okay to stop anyone, what was interesting, actually, was what the judge said about press freedoms and about the role of a journalist. Because he did actually say in his ruling that it constituted an indirect interference with press freedom. But the threat posed by him having these documents far outweighed, any pesky press freedom stuff. But The Guardian has made quite a big kind of statement that it is the journalist's role to question government. There should be a balance between the responsibilities of government and journalists when it comes to security information. And that when security services use the argument that, you know, a journalist couldn't possibly understand the jigsaw of information to know what they can release safely and what they can't release safely, which is what The Guardian's been doing, actually is inhibiting their press freedoms. And the judge said this is all rubbish. He just basically said this is not true. The journalists do not have this level of responsibility. They do not have the knowledge to make these decisions. And is basically kind of throwing out any
but perhaps,
of their aspirations.
But
there.
Perhaps on an individual's basis, but for an organisation.
Yeah.
There are always people in organisations who know more about individual topics or laws or you know, responsibilities. And these decisions get made by groups of people.
I think they just don't care. They say legally the journalist doesn't have that role. The government has the role to protect the people and decide what is okay and what is not okay.
So what does this change? Does this change anything?
It just means that you can get stopped probably more easily.
But The Guardian's going to carry on leaking, so is the Washington Post and the other sites that are putting these documents out there.
Yeah, well, you would think if the judge was making this ruling, then you would be actively going after anyone who has this documentation, because it were, you know, or anyone involved in it that travels abroad because they have this information and can be stopped at the airport to question. So they're obviously not actively doing that. They just don't want to pay David Miranda or say they've done anything wrong.
Wikipedia could become a 1,193,014, is that how you say that, page book, apparently. A campaign on crowdfunding site Indiegogo wants you to donate money to fund a project that will see the community-driven encyclopedia printed out page by page and turned into a regular old physical encyclopedia. At least this is according to a story on Wired.co.uk by Katie Collins, who I am inclined to believe. Quote, we think this is the best way to experience the size of Wikipedia by transforming it into the physical medium of books. And that is a quote from the Wikipedia Book Project team, writing on their Indiegogo campaign page. The quote continues, containing the most volumes and edited by the largest number of contributors, the printed edition will be a work of record-breaking dimensions. Now, this is a really interesting idea. I remember back in the day, I think people thought that a community-written encyclopedia was a mad idea. I actually think it's more mad, a bunch of people sitting in a room at a publishing house saying, guys, let's write about everything ever in a book. That to me seems more bizarre than let's just pull together the sum of all human knowledge.
Yeah, bit because by nothing's bit. Ever going to change.
Yeah, well, they're looking to raise £30,000, $50,000 officially, as a target. And Wikipedia's 4 million articles will be printed out into 1,000 books, 1,200 pages each. There will be continuous page numbering, though, throughout the volumes. And the final page will be 1193014. So it's kind of one massive book, but it is, I suppose, for logistical reasons at best, split into 1,000 volumes. And then it's possible that if there's enough interest and enough money is raised, an exhibition of the book, which will take place first at the Wikimania conference in London in August, could depart on a world tour. My question, though, is does this serve any benefit, or is this basically a big fat PR stunt for a bunch of people who really like Wikipedia? And I really like Wikipedia.
I love Wikipedia, but this seems to go against its purpose, and is a huge waste of paper.
But what it might do, and I guess that probably is still a PR stunt, is highlight the amount of information that has been generated on Wikipedia, and that we don't, you know, when you go onto Wikipedia homepage, although we go down rabbit holes, you can't see that volume, and I guess being able to understand it in a very kind of physical form might be quite interesting.
And it is sometimes those nuggets of information that I find most useful. I mean, I donate to Wikipedia every year because the number of page views alone that I pull up for old articles of bands or albums or songs and producers and things like that is hugely valuable. Now, I can't imagine those are going to get printed in this book, particularly not most of the bands that I listen to, as no one's heard of them. But I don't think that this really addresses the strongest side of Wikipedia, which is the fact that it's always evolving and people can always make changes. I mean, I like to think that this, you know, as another experiment, is everyone gets a red pen who votes or who donates for this and can go along to the actual physical encyclopedia and cross things out and update it when it's changed.
That I like. That's really interesting, because that is, if you're going to make a statement, you may as well let people draw all over it.
And yeah.
They should combine it with that installation that we saw at the Wikipedia's 10th birthday party, which was sort of this ceiling-mounted, kind of like receipt paper printers, and they would print off, or maybe it was like ticket printers, but every time someone edited Wikipedia, it would print off the edit onto this little piece of paper, which would then tumble to the floor.
Yeah.
Maybe you need the books, and then that on top of it, and then you have some kind of weird...
I went to that party. Were you there as well?
Yes. That's why I talked about it.
Were we all there? I can't remember.
We were definitely there.
We were there. I remember standing under that, actually, and having all these edits land on my head. It was like the world's smartest rain. Okay, well, if you do want to donate to this project, if you want to see the world's largest waste of paper come true, then search for Wikipedia Book on wired.co.uk and follow those helpful little links that Katie's put in there. Liv, last up in the news portion before we get to some feedback and, of course, our large WhatsApp discussion is a UNICEF challenge. Put down your phone, save lives.
Yes.
Strong, powerful humanitarian sentiments there, Liv.
Yeah, I'm currently not saving any lives by holding this tablet in my hand. But UNICEF is challenging people to see how long you can go without looking at or fiddling with your phone. And if you're anything like us, it's probably a couple of minutes before you have to have a look. Is there a text? Is there a new tweet?
Yeah.
Well, if you can abstain for a long period, you'll be able to save lives thanks to this program called the TAP Project, which is UNICEF's Clean Water Initiative. And it's got loads of sponsors who have pledged to donate $1 for every minute that you don't touch your phone, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
So to take part, you just need to go to a URL, uniceftapproject.org, in your mobile phone's browser, and then you follow the instructions. And the browser will then be able to tell you when your phone is steady, and you can start a clock running, and you can start to generate money for UNICEF, which is a really, really cool initiative.
So what's the record? Do we have any records?
Well, depressingly, as you're waiting, as your time kind of is totting up, it shows you little stats. And at least when Katie wrote this story, the record in the UK was just 1 hour.
Wow.
I think we can do better than that.
I'm going to set mine before I go to bed tonight and save loads of lives. I keep meaning to do this. I can't believe I forgot, because I believe that dollar goes a long way, and that's one day's worth of water.
Yeah. What's bizarre is we get sent basically every phone that gets released, and we have cupboards full of these things. Why don't we just turn them all on?
Yes.
And just leave them all? I mean, we could be saving lives every second. I think this is a great thing. I would love, the worst offender of this thing of playing with your phones is my brother, Andy. He is one of these people that you can be talking to him and you can sort of see his eyes slowly go away to the phone. I doubt he could do a minute. Genuinely, you can't sit and watch something with Andy, because he will just phone will be out constantly. Like, dude, what's so important? Put the damn thing down.
That drives me mad.
I think he should heed this challenge and could raise a lot of money. I think he'd go mad, but I think he'd save lives, and that's a
yes,
a great challenge. So he listens to the show. This is a challenge officially. We'll see. Okay, well, yes, as Liv says, if you want to go to unicef-tapproject.com, I think it was the URL.
.org.
.org, of course, and sign up and let us know how many minutes you can survive without playing with a phone. Well, we're going to take a quick ad break, but when we come back, what's up with WhatsApp? Haha, I bet I'm the first person to do that this minute in this room. We're going to have a big conversation about WhatsApp, the acquisition. It's Facebook's largest acquisition to date, $19 billion in total. And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about what this means for the service, for Facebook, for you. That's all coming up. Do you want a free audiobook? We know you do, because you keep signing up for them. Audible.co.uk is still offering our listeners a free download from a catalogue of 80,000 for being a Wired.co.uk podcast listener. You can sign up in a few clicks, download any book, and there's no commitment, by going to audible.co.uk/wired, putting in a few details and downloading a book. If you like it, you can stick around. If you don't, you can cancel and you won't get charged. So no reason not to give it a go. That's audible.co.uk/wired. Okay, it's the discussion portion of today's show. And this week, our topic is WhatsApp as we ride the Technosaurus. Well, we've had to put a big saddle on the Technosaurus this week because, my goodness, there's a lot to talk about. Facebook has acquired mobile messaging service WhatsApp for $19 billion. Billion. That's about 11.4 billion pounds, and it's the company's largest acquisition to date. WhatsApp currently has over 450 million users around the world, which makes it one of the largest messaging platforms on the planet. And interestingly, Facebook recently tried to buy Snapchat for $3 billion, as some people will remember, but was turned down. And earlier this week, Viber was bought by Japanese firm Rakuten for $900 million, about 540 million pounds. And Rakuten's a massive e-commerce company. It owns Play.com, the Kobo e-reader brands, things like that. So it's been a very good week to be an over-the-top messaging service. So Zuckerberg is going to pay, I suppose not personally, but Facebook with his authorization, is going to pay $4 billion in cash to WhatsApp's 50 employees and around $12 billion in stock in order to buy WhatsApp. And an agreement also says that 3 billion extra stock shares, or restricted stock specifically, will be given to the founders and employees over 4 years, which is basically to keep them around so they don't take their money and run off, basically. So WhatsApp co-founder and chief executive Jan Koum will join Facebook's board, and the company has stated that WhatsApp will remain autonomous and operate independently. Very interesting week for WhatsApp, and a very lucrative week as well. I think this is fascinating. Liat?
I hadn't realised until this morning that they were going to be autonomous, which now I am excited about.
Yep.
I had thought it was just going to be a big old integration merger, Facebook watching me more.
They always say that, though, don't they? You remember when Yahoo acquired Tumblr, and it was made very clear that, you know, Yahoo wasn't going to be meddling with Tumblr's, you know, free ways, but sooner or later it always happens.
It did, yeah. Well, I mean, Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion and hasn't, I don't think, really changed anything significant there. Yeah. Facebook also recently launched the Paper app, which was a way of attracting people who maybe don't like the traditional way of browsing Facebook. And that has really very little Facebook branding on it at all. Mm. It's obviously powered by Facebook, and it requires a Facebook account and obviously some friends on there. But it's run as a sort of fairly independent operation, at least as far as the user experience is concerned.
Well, that's the way to do it. You don't buy something for $19 billion unless they're doing something right, and it obviously has a great deal of potential, but it would be disastrous to, you know, mess with that straight off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, WhatsApp is a group of messaging services called OTT, over the top messaging services. So it follows the likes of BBM, BlackBerry Messenger. Obviously, then we've now got a lot more entrance in that market: Google Hangouts and iMessage, obviously BBM, Viber, Snapchat, WeChat. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of these that have millions and millions of users each, hundreds of millions in the case of some of these. And WeChat is a massive one over in China and Japan. But there's been a lot of questions asked about why Facebook bought the service, given that it already has something that's effectively a Snapchat clone. It also has a Facebook Messenger, which can be used as an independent messaging platform. You know, it's a standalone app. And for the tune of $19 billion in total, you don't put $19 billion on the table unless you really think this is going to be worth having. This isn't an acquihire where people buy companies basically to get the talent or the patents.
No,
this is a very small team that does something Facebook already sort of does. So there's been a lot of question marks about why the hell do they want this?
But I guess it's whether or not the 450 million people who are using WhatsApp are also the same 450 million people using, or some of the billion people using Facebook. And yeah. I suspect that's not the case. I suspect it's quite a different audience. It's often people who have rejected Facebook.
I agree.
And I feel like perhaps it's not that Facebook needs the functionality. It just needs to not be competing against WhatsApp.
I think so, too. I mean, there was a recent earnings call where Facebook admitted that teens, specifically teens, are spending less time on Facebook and using tools like WhatsApp. So it's kind of, I think maybe this is a way of pushing the trend in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
It hurts my head to think how they're going to get their $19 billion back.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, WhatsApp is a paid service.
Yeah.
You know, it has an annual fee. Previous to being an annual fee, it was originally 59 pence download, then 69p when Apple put the pricing up on all downloads.
I've still never paid for WhatsApp.
You will have done, unless you downloaded it right at the beginning. It launched in 2009 and was free, and they were doing about 10,000 downloads a day. But then they actually introduced a fee later that year, or about 12 months later, and the downloads dropped to about 1,000 a day or something. And then they've moved to this sort of quasi-subscription model. So unless you got it right
don't
in the
remember
early
that.
Days.
I don't remember paying anything. Free, yeah. I only usually click on free.
But it's a weird one, WhatsApp, because there are a lot of competing services that I think do what it does better. So, I mean, WhatsApp, firstly, is only on mobile phones. There's no tablet version. It has to be tied to a phone number, and we'll come back to why that is the case. Whereas other services like Snapchat or like Google Hangouts even, you know, iMessage as well, they're cross-platform. So you don't just have to use a phone and a phone number. You can use it on a tablet. You can use it on a desktop. You can have it on multiple devices at once. You can have a message come in and appear in five places, and you just reply on whichever one you're looking at the time.
But I feel as though the fact is that the teenage audience that it's been so successful with do all have mobile phones and don't necessarily have all the multiple devices, and it is meant to be a sort of personal chat, well, you know, either one-to-one or one-to-many chat tool, and that's best done hidden under the desk.
I use it most often for people who, some of my friends who don't, they don't have all tablets and they don't have everything, and also friends abroad. It's the quickest way to get hold of someone instantly.
Definitely.
They're not looking at their emails all the time. They're not looking at Facebook. WhatsApp is definitely the way I communicate with them.
But don't you think that it would benefit at this point having at least support on a device like a tablet? You know, tablet sales, the iPad didn't exist, for example, when WhatsApp came out. The iPad was announced in 2010 and WhatsApp was released in 2009. It was actually going to launch and be called Zap. They changed the name, I think, when they made some decisions, or Zap was one of the names they were going to call it. And so a lot of the decisions, I think, and the ground rules that they set out in the earlier days were not even relevant considerations at the time. There were no tablets. You know, smartphones had nowhere near the ubiquity that they have now, and certainly not the range of price points and platforms and what have you. And so I kind of feel that at this point, and particularly with Facebook, I mean, over half of its revenue now comes from mobiles.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is coming from tablets. And I don't know, is the time to evolve that?
It must be. But I mean, as you've, you know, very clearly pointed out at the beginning, there's 50 staff members at WhatsApp. They haven't had a huge number of people to expand their product offering or across different platforms. Having that partnership with Facebook will perhaps allow them to kind of unlock some of that potential. Mm. At least not, you know, they'll have the resources to kind of launch an app within 2 weeks, whatever Facebook turned things around in.
Yes, WhatsApp, they're very good about gestating good ideas very slowly but very well. They're not a company that rolls out feature after feature after feature. It stays very simple. And their argument for the phone number usage is that it gets around having logins. It gets around having a username and a password to forget. And I think that's incredibly smart. And certainly one of the reasons it's been so successful is down to that turn it on and just start using it, this simplicity. David Rowan, editor of the magazine, has got a feature that's turned out to be very, very well timed, coming out in the next issue of Wired in March, the beginning of March. David, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
What impression did you get when you were visiting the WhatsApp guys?
It took us a long time to get access to them. They're in an unmarked office somewhere in the centre of Mountain View, and they haven't done publicity. So just before Christmas, they gave us access, and I went there for 3 days and got to know the founders. And what you discover straight away is that they're not into the hype. They're not a typical Silicon Valley startup of 20-somethings. The two founders, one of them is going to be, when we come out in a few days, 38. The other's going to be 42. They're pretty established people in the Valley, both worked for Yahoo for some time. And they keep such a low profile that you wouldn't know who they are. One of them is a Ukrainian immigrant called Jan Koum, who, when he came over to the States at 16, collected food stamps two blocks away in Mountain View. He was on welfare. And the other one is a man called Brian Acton, who got to know Jan when they were both at Yahoo, and who's much more kind of all-American, suburban, grew up in places like Florida. And they're quite a good team. They talk about being the yin and the yang to each other. I watched them do some work in the office to try and work out how to do voice messaging better. And Jan Koum was playing with a couple of walkie-talkies to try and work out what's the minimum number of touches to create voice. So they've created a way to record your voice, and whilst keeping the thumb down, if you want to delete it, you just swipe your thumb to the left. And if you want to keep it and send it, you just release your thumb. And they're thinking, how can we get rid of as many stages? In designing the app from the start, Jan Koum said he spent one summer going through Skype accounts. He'd lost his login 3 times and he couldn't remember what email he used to get it back. And he thought, why does it have to be this complicated? Why can't I just allow my phone to identify itself to the service through its number? So you don't need a login. You don't need an online name. You just have your phone and its number. The other things he was obsessed with, he grew up in Soviet communist Ukraine. And first of all, the state monitored people. His family talked a lot about the dissidents, the Sakharovs. People he knew growing up were taken away for questioning. And he said, I want an app that doesn't store your data. So they don't keep the messages. It just goes through their server and it's encrypted between the phone and the server, and they don't want to keep it. They don't want to know who you are beyond your phone number. They don't know demographically who you are. And that's also linked to his obsession with not having advertising. Again, he grew up in Ukraine where there weren't adverts, and he wanted to find a business model that wouldn't rely on advertising. So their model is, it's often a free download, and most of the time people are paying $1 a year for their WhatsApp. The challenge now is they're part of a commercially driven enterprise whose main business model is selling advertising and getting lots of data about the users. Facebook has said WhatsApp will still run independently. But you have to wonder, if Facebook has paid $19 billion, how they're going to recoup that value. It's one thing to say, yes, it's going to get us more access to the mobile consumer, which is great, but will you be able to serve commercial messages through those devices, through that app? And will you risk tarnishing the culture? It was really interesting, because this happened... My interviews with the WhatsApp team happened before the acquisition was on the horizon. They talked about getting lots of offers, but they're just, you know, thinking about building. And Brian Acton, the co-founder, said to me, you know, I can't imagine being part of a big company. To me, it's unethical. It goes against my personal integrity, he said, because we've made a contract with our users that we're not going to clutter their experience. We're not going to commercialize it. And I guess everybody has a price. And $19 billion sounds a fair price.
It's not a bad price. Well, last question before I let you go is, was there anything you were expecting at WhatsApp, either with the people or the office or the culture, that you found to be completely untrue, that was really surprisingly different to what you expected?
Because they'd been so low-key and had not really done press before, it was quite hard to have specific expectations. When I went into the office, I think what I was surprised most by was the obsession with customer service. So they've got 50 staff, so that's 9 million users per headcount, which is pretty impressive. And a lot of those staff are customer service support, speaking in the middle of Mountain View in Mandarin, in Arabic, in Dutch. And it's the obsessive worry that we're not going to deliver the service that we've promised people. They have a chart with their uptime for that period and that whole year, actually. And it was something like 99.999937% uptime. And a few days before I'd been there, they had a software bug that had brought their server down for a short time, or one of their servers. I think they had 600 servers. And, you know, that was what their focus was. They carry pages. They don't sleep if they can't ensure 100% availability. And I think we can all learn from not being distracted, going for the best possible simple customer service, having that obsessive focus, and then just allowing your community to do your marketing for you. They've never spent a penny on advertising, but by delivering a product that people want and love and use, those people will introduce their family and their friend, and it's an extraordinary viral growth.
Well, look out for David's feature that will be out at the start of March on tablets and phones. We do both. And obviously in paper form on a newsstand. That's out, I think, on the 6th of March. Okay, we asked for feedback last week. We specifically asked for criticism and comments, and man, we got them. Our inbox was full. We've picked out quite a few here, various comments that have come in. We're going to start with a comment that came in from Lisa, and she is commenting on the Doge doggy story that apparently won't die, but she has a really good insight that I hadn't heard before. She says, "Dearest Nate, Liv, Liat, etc. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, big fan of the podcast, and love getting all the latest tech and science news. As a language and linguistics lover, the discussion over the pronunciation of Dogecoin, has been on my mind since you brought us that story, and I can't stop mulling it over. So imagine just how elated I was when a little trip to Venice cleared the matter up for me. Part of our visit included the Doge's palace. Yes, bingo, it was 100% pronounced Doge, i.e. not like the G in dog," and she has provided a dictionary definition here as well. So definitely that's how I'm going to be pronouncing it. Lots of love and keep up the good work, Lisa. I have to say, I'm convinced.
I'm not, because I don't think the etymology of the meme has anything to do with kind of Latin, has any Latin origins. I feel as though it's completely separate to that.
But the word is spelt the same.
Doesn't matter. Just because word is spelt the same doesn't necessarily mean they're always pronounced the same.
Is it scone or scone? Because I believe...
Scone.
But it's bones.
Yeah, therein lies the problem.
That's because you're south and you're north.
Yeah.
Midlands.
How do you say it?
Scone.
You're both wrong. We've got an email from Andrew that came in to see, I was a bit surprised to hear somebody got offended by your podcast last week, as earlier in the show, I was thinking how much I enjoyed it. I love the fact that you cover stories of how advances in technology may have an impact on people, which always leads to some interesting ethical discussions, sometimes silly. It's great to hear lots of positive stories on the podcast. You guys are objective. There's no black and white. Everything is grey with you guys, which is a good thing. It's like Audible Breaking Bad without the meth lab. I have absolutely no idea what that. I've never watched Breaking Bad.
I love
Bad.
That.
Yeah. We might have a meth lab here. How do you know?
Yeah. He said, I'd love to work for your team. Do you offer any jobs, or can people just walk in off the street without any experience or qualifications? No. Strangely enough, Andrew, no. Someone cannot walk off the street and say, hey, I have no experience and don't know anything. Can I work for you? Many have tried. All have failed. But we're hiring an editor for the start section of the mag at the moment.
But that might require some experience or qualification in journalism.
Yeah, if you're walking around the street right now thinking, oh, that sounds like a great idea, I'm inexperienced and have no idea what I'm doing, don't apply. But thank you, Andrew, for the nice comments. We had some comments on production quality, which we normally, yes, we get praised actually for our production quality, which I'm always pleased about. But both long-time listener Richard Gunther, who had said, I've been listening and learning since Nate and the team started the show, and your production is typically top-notch. And also a commenter from Jonathan. Both had pointed out that we occasionally have inconsistencies with sound qualities with either certain vocal levels or the sound of our little sound bites. So I'm hoping that this week the sound bites, the sort of little chip tunes that we have between our features and things, aren't as loud, because we've had two or three people who have said, oh, I think these are really loud, and I think sometimes it's down to the headphones. I definitely noticed that certain headphones make the audio parts of our show sound a little louder than they sound to us. We monitor things on a very flat set of monitoring headphones, so we're going to have a little experiment, and hopefully for the few people that do notice that can sometimes be an issue, we'll be cleaned up. But thank you very much, Richard and Jonathan, for your feedback. It's really useful, and obviously anyone else who's listening has feedback on the show, positive or negative. We really do like criticism, constructively preferably, and praise for what we're doing well, because it helps us keep the show evolving and serving you guys better. So podcast@wired.co.uk is where all of those came from and where you can send yours. I think that'll do.
Great.
I think yes. I'm off to spend some doge coins.
Doge.
Whatever.
Doggy.
Bye.
Bye.
You finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.